Ken McLeod, thank you very much for doing this. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Not a problem. Just in case, if anyone's interested, the original plan, not that you invited me to your house, but you were up for doing this face to face. I was going to come up and see you. And then I looked at the map. I still may do that because I'm planning I think we spoke on email. I'm planning to make an Ian M. Banks documentary, and I will come and see you in person maybe next year. But I looked on the map, and is that the Outer Hebrides where you live? You are perched out across the sea in Scotland, right?
Oh, goodness me, no.
Where are you?
The Outer Hebrides is where I came from. I was born on the Isle of Lewis. I actually live in Gurrook, which is a small town on the Firth of Clyde. Which is, you know where Glasgow is?
Indeed, yeah.
It's to the west of Glasgow.
So you're out there a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not as bad then. Because for some reason, I thought you lived out in somewhere else. And I thought, hang on a minute, that's about 12 hours drive. And then I have to get across and I could get to New York and back in the time it took to drive to you. Still, it's a long way off, and we will do it in person. But are you out in the countryside? Is it the wild wilderness of Scotland, or you're in a town?
I'm in a town, a small town that is sort of facing on to, not exactly the wild wilderness, but I can show you, if you don't mind a clumsy moment while I turn the camera around.
Of course.
Yeah, go for that.
Let the colouring adjust.
Oh, look at that.
It's a bit wild moment because the sea is...
Yeah, that's kind of what I expected. I've been to Scotland a few times, and it always looks like that. That's not true, of course, but okay. Is that an inspiration for your writing, looking out to sea at the stormy weather?
Yes, it certainly is, and the sunny weather too. Yeah. I mean, one of the regular features of, well, not regular, but frequent features of what the stretch of sea you've just seen, of where the Clyde, the River Clyde, opens out eventually into the Atlantic, many miles further west, is you see nuclear submarines going past.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because the naval base at Fast Lane is just upriver a little bit and round a corner.
So they actually pop up and you can see the turret or whatever it's called, the little bit.
Conning tower, absolutely. Yeah, you can see the whole thing, like a gigantic whale with a great fin on its back. Yeah.
It's a different world. Well, I'm in the middle of the English countryside, and it's pretty boring. The flattest, you know, the nothing part in the heart of England. It's nice enough, but I yearn for the dramatic landscapes, which you seem to have. So I'll come up and have a look next year. I've got an easy question or a conversation point to start off with, nice and simple. Are you a techno utopian socialist? And for those that don't know, what does that actually mean?
Well, I'm not sure I know what it means. I think you know, somebody offered to change my Wikipedia bio, but I said no, leave it alone. That's good enough for me. The sensible answer is that techno-utopian socialist probably means something like what you see on Star Trek. But no, not necessarily that advanced. But the basic idea, which I think is defensible at least, is that with sufficiently advanced technology, you could have a society with, if not without money, at least without, that isn't a post-capitalist society.
Yeah.
That was enabled people to live, like everybody in the world to live comfortably, which I think is a well worthwhile goal. And I'm just, in other respects, and just a boringly ordinary socialist. I don't know quite why that came across. I think one reason was I did write my third novel, which is called The Cassini Division, is set in a definitely techno-utopian society that calls itself socialism, the world commonwealth, and so on.
So something you think we can get to or we should be aiming for? I mean, how far off do you see this? What would we need to do to get to that point? Or is it something that you think humanity will naturally grow into because we'll just have better technology?
Well, I don't think better technology will do the trick on its own. I think you need to organize consciously and politically to do it, which is far too, I think that's far too big a topic to really go into here. My late friend Ian Banks had this idea, which he came up with completely independently of any really political thinking, where he tried to imagine that you took a really, really good society. When he was coming up with this idea for a story about a sort of doomed, conflicted mercenary who was in some ways a very bad man, but was working in the service of a really good society. So right. Ian decided, what kind of society would I really, really like to live in? And he came up with this, with the culture, this enormously technologically super advanced utopia. And I had a discussion with him about that when we were students, I guess, and or whatever. And I said to him, you couldn't get there without political struggle. And his answer was to show me a pocket calculator. He had been working on a building site, I believe, doing some kind of construction work during the summer when he was a student. And he was able to use the calculator to show the workers on the site that they were being underpaid, you know, even in terms of the bargain, the contract they had, they were being underpaid. And he proved it with the calculator, and their union rep proved it with the calculator to the boss. So they got their pay. And what he seemed to be implying by this was that with, you know, technology in the hands of ordinary people, even as something as simple as a pocket calculator could begin to shift the balance. And presumably, well, he did think that computers and phones and so on were doing the same. I mean, Ian was this kind of stuff that was science fictional speculation for Ian. He was a very straightforwardly old Labour type democratic socialist with a Scottish nationalist or Scottish. He believed in Scottish independence, put it that way, but his politics were old Labour left.
You think that seeps into his writing of the culture?
No doubt it did. It certainly seeped into his mainstream fiction, which is where he usually has some fairly acerbic character making these points.
I think a lot of people, if they're asked to sort of pick a science fiction universe that they would like to live in, and I guess we want to pick some sort of utopia, many people do pick the culture. But what I find fascinating about it is we almost give up who we are and hand over all the power and the decisions to artificial intelligence, I guess. We have to trust that they will do better than us. So do you, in your writing, do you come from the same angle? Do you trust in an artificial intelligence that it can make better decisions than humans? Or Are you scared of artificial intelligence?
Yes, and no. I don't. In some of my novels, I have a future utopian humanity that is, without really knowing it, being looked after by an artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
But that's not my. That is not what I would advocate. And I don't. I mean, I think artificial intelligence is a tool that we can use, just like any advanced machinery. I don't really fear artificial intelligence. I don't think that anything like a singularity or self-aware artificial intelligence in the real world is likely to come along anytime soon. However, I'm in my novels, I am perfectly happy to have human equivalent AI in the next few decades, and AI pursuing its own agenda, etc. Because, in a way, that's what, it's not exactly so much what is expected of science fiction. It's just a fun thing to have in your story. Like, it's hardly ever the major point of the story. It's a fun thing to have, like FTL, which again is almost certainly impossible. But you know, that doesn't stop me writing novels about it.
Yeah. But AI feels like we can actually see it growing in the real world, wouldn't you say? We can see computers getting faster and faster and making more what we perceive as autonomous decisions, and we are pushing it in that direction. Yes, we can write about it in science fiction, but it's one of those things very different to FTL that we can see coming. It's one of those parts of science fiction. There is definitely something on the horizon that's going to appear in the real world. And the community seems to be split, and science in general, of whether it's a good thing or not. I don't think we can stop it. I think humans are somehow geared up to just make something like that. It's going to naturally pop up, right?
Yeah, I think very advanced artificial intelligence is certainly fairly close. Whether it's going to do things that, you know, we don't, well, it already does things we don't intend it to do. Algorithms have unintended consequences and so on. But I don't worry about an unfriendly AI arising and taking over the world or anything.
No, it's a bit like worrying about evil aliens showing up as well, right? If they do, we can't do much about it. We can observe, and I don't know. It's so out there. I guess AI doesn't get the same rap because we feel like we've got some level of control over it. Like, just because it came from our silicon or whatever, our design, that we would have some grip on it. I'm not so sure that's the truth. I think once it gets out of the box, whatever it is, 50 years from now, I think it's going to be so fast and out there that it's going to be like meeting an alien, because it's going to be instantly so many steps ahead. And I guess it's kind of impossible to say whether that's going to be a danger, or it'll just be able to turn around and answer all of our questions and solve everything just like that. I'm an optimist. Do you want to do some books? You've got some science fiction books to talk about, yeah?
Well, yeah. Well, as always, it's hard to pick five, and as they say, you know, the golden age of science fiction is 12, and I have picked books that most of which I encountered at a fairly impressionable age, and although not all, and I'll go through them.
You do as many as you like. I only put five there just to help guide the authors to kind of pick stuff. But so these are the ones that are the most influential. These are the ones that you've kind of you reread again and mean a lot to you, yeah?
They're all ones that at least reread, that have meant a lot to me when I read them first. And the one I'll start off with, Cities in Flight, mm-hmm. by James Blish, which is still in print,
yeah,
at least electronically. And I think I read the first one that I read was the second book in that series, which came out as a juvenile, you know, YA, as we call it nowadays, called A Life for the Stars, about this kid who gets essentially press ganged onto a city that is about to take off into interstellar space.
Yeah.
And I think the first chapter of that, first page of that, the first chapter is called Press Gang. From the embankment to the long abandoned Erie Lackawanna, Pennsylvania Railroad, Chris sat silently watching the city of Scranton, Pennsylvania, preparing to take off, and sucked meditatively upon the red and white clover around him. And it goes on, he's watching this rundown industrial city 1,000 years from now, and powering up its spin dizzy fields. And, you know, the other, he meets the mayor, eventually gets traded into New York, which is a much bigger and more impressive city. And the whole thing is completely loopy space opera, and episodic, and has quite a few chronological inconsistencies and so on, because Blish presumably wrote them over a period of time as magazine stories. But yeah. It's nevertheless, you know, it was tremendously interesting and exciting when I read it, and it still bears rereading. I mean, I like the character of John Amalfi, who was the mayor of New York, and who, in the end, if he doesn't quite outlive the universe, he affects the next universe.
To my shame, I haven't read any Blish. I have a handful of classic sci-fi authors that I haven't read anything, and it's kind of embarrassing. However, it does mean I get to enjoy it for the first time soon. Cities in Flight and A Case of Conscience, have you read that?
I've read A Case of Conscience, all right, and reread it. In fact, I may have written an introduction to it.
Yeah, that's the one that people say, you really need to cross that one off the list, you know. So I think that's the top of my list.
Yeah, it's very short.
Yeah.
And it's in two halves, and it's really clever. Another one which I read, maybe not long after the Cities in Flight books, probably when I was still in secondary school, is A Canticle for Leibowitz.
Oh, there you go. Beautiful book. Yeah.
You know that one, yes.
I do know that one, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a book so full of wit and wisdom, and really, oh gosh, that's another one I've written a masterworks introduction to.
Oh, right.
Yeah, in fact, you've forgotten that. And I've probably said all that I need to say about it in that introduction. But basically, in some ways, it's as far as I can tell, it is the kindliest take on Catholicism that you have in science fiction. And Walter Miller was actually a convert to Catholicism. I don't know what he was a convert from. And it's very orthodox pre-Vatican II Catholicism, Latin masses and so on. And a very strong there's a kind of Catholic thing, right? A Catholic ethical position right through it, which is that all human life is sacred. And at the beginning, this comes out as that mutants, no matter how deformed, are under the protection of the church, you know. And at the end, at the very end, there is the moral issue is pushed over euthanasia. About people, you know, the state is offering euthanasia to people who have been fatally irradiated in the nuclear war. Spoilers, there's another nuclear war at the end. And yet at the same time, it's detached and ironic. It doesn't thump any tables. It's quite detached and ironic. And light, like the monks are often funny. Yet at the same time, we take them seriously. And the way the story goes through a long, long period of centuries in three phases, and, you know, it still maintains that continuity rather cleverly, in the same way as the monasteries maintain a continuity. And it gets you thinking. One of the really eerie things about that is that by the end of the book, which was actually, I think, written in the late 50s, you've got the feeling that you're seeing a world very like the early 60s, or slightly more advanced. You know, they have satellites, they have starships of some kind.
Yeah.
Cars, and a worldwide nuclear balance of terror, which has just ended. And you recognize that world. It's a world that you can imagine living in. And then if that world is like our world, what is our world? And I was talking about this to my son many years ago as we were walking around the ruins of a Roman camp at Cramond near Edinburgh. And we were chatting about this book, and he said, "Oh, you mean we're a post-catastrophe civilization?" And that was it, bingo. That was something I took from it.
You think that's the analogy that Miller was saying, we've already gone through one of these phases? It always sparks debate, that book, because like you say, I'm never quite sure what Miller is saying. Is he pro-human? You know, is he sympathetic towards the human race, possibly? Or is that the church's job? But then he does destroy everyone kind of three times over. He's saying that we will just keep going around in these cycles and crumbling, only to come up again and never learning the lesson, right?
Well, that is more or less, and that's Christianity for you. My story of reading science fiction was, like most people, well, many people who become science fiction readers, you encounter it in your teens and you get besotted with it. And then, in many cases, you get a little jaded with it by the end of your teens. I certainly did. And more or less, I wasn't reading a lot of SF in my 20s and 30s. And sometime in the 1980s, I came across this book, Neuromancer.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely blew me away. Because I was doing an indescribably boring office job as a clerk. Computers were only just coming in, so we had to, you know, in those days you had to retype the same thing over and over and over again.
Wow.
I was a dispatch clerk and was extremely bored. But computers were coming into the office, and the way that the computer tech who were setting up the system talked, I realized was very like what this book was, the cyberspace of this book. He, the way that he visualized the programs and the problems and so on was as if he had a mental cyberspace in front of him and he was moving about in some imagined space. And the wonderful thing about Neuromancer and cyberpunk when it came along, which it was part of, was that suddenly SF was paying attention to the actual world around us. Much closer attention to a world that wasn't going to give us what we'd expected in the golden age of SF and wasn't even necessarily going to give us what the new wave had expected. These variously rundown or trippy futures. And this was a world of giant corporations, of enormously enhanced communications technology, of completely incomprehensibly vast machinations and machinery. And all of this experienced not from the level of people who are in charge or movers and shakers, but from street level.
Yeah, from the shadows. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think of Gibson's actual writing? I've had to force myself to enjoy Neuromancer the first time. I guess I just didn't understand what it was and what was really actually happening. I found it quite dense. And then when I reread it a few years ago, I now really love what he's done there, but I still need to go back for another dip. Because I still find it quite hard to get to grips with completely. As an author who writes this kind of thing, you probably don't have that problem. Is that fair to say?
My problem with Gibson is that I find his style so utterly brilliant.
You're just jealous, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, Gibson has a fantastic economy of style, I think. And you know, the book, there's another, one of his short stories, The Gernsback Continuum, is just packed with perfect sentences, I think. But I'll tell you, I'll just read it. This was what grabbed me as soon as I read the book. I opened the book, I think.
Yeah.
We all know the first line, the sky above the port was the colour of television tuned to a dead channel.
Of course.
Yeah, but it's not like him using, Case heard someone say, as he shouldered his way through the crowd around the door of the chat. It's like my body's developed this massive drug deficiency. It was a sprawl voice and a sprawl joke. The Chatsuba was a bar for professional expatriates. You could drink there for a week and never hear two words in Japanese. Now, the amount of information that's packed into these few sentences is astounding. And you're right there, somebody shouldering their way through a crowd around a door and so on. I really like that. And Gibson has gone on doing extraordinary things. I'm afraid I've fallen a bit behind in keeping up with his work. We're currently watching The Peripheral, and it's making
me... I hear great things.
Yes, it's a terrific TV series, and they've obviously spared no expense in making it look very convincing. My next one is one very different from the others, and it came as a complete surprise to me reading it.
Is that part of the... There's a big series of books, right? About 25 or something. Is that one of those?
Well, I think there's at least a dozen. The one of the Vorkosigan books, yes.
That's the ones, and yeah. I haven't read them, but they get recommended quite a bit.
Yeah. I only ever encountered them thanks to, in the 90s, I was on a Usenet news group, which you might have to go back to now, Twitter is imploding.
Yeah.
A news group called Rec Arts SF Written, as in rec.sf.arts.written. And it was the place to meet people, other people who read science fiction online, you know. And I met a lot of fantastic people there, including Jo Walton, who's a Welsh lady by origin, who now lives in Canada.
Who's read everything, apparently.
Yes. Yeah. And I said nice things about my books too, which was very gratifying. Jo and numerous other women on that group would be raving about Bujold. And so I decided to give it a try, and I got the first one. This book consists of two novels which came out separate and are probably still in print separately, Shards of Honor and Barriar. Once I'd read these, I immediately went to the science fiction bookshop in Edinburgh, where I lived at the time, and bought as many as I could. I think it was in Transreal Fiction. Transreal Fiction. It's a great SF bookshop in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And I bought them all and read them at enormous speed and shoved them at my daughter because I remember enthusing about them to Ian and saying with slight exaggeration, it's like James Bond written by Jane Austen.
Ah.
There's a full of social comedy and it's also got lots of colourful, adventurous action. And the very first novel, Shards of Honour, is basically follows the plot of numerous romantic category romance type fictions. Not that I've read very many of them, but I get the general idea, which is find the most dangerous man in the universe and marry him. And that's what Cordelia does. Cordelia is an explorer from a very sort of social democratic-like planet who encounters a guy from a much more militaristic, it seems to her, empire called Barriar. And Barriar was isolated from the rest of the galaxy for several hundred years because the wormhole that connected them with the rest closed up. So she's got this wonderful universe where you've got wormhole travel and occasionally a planet will be isolated. And by the time contact was re-established with Barriar, they'd had an atomic war, they'd reinvented the feudal system, and they had several more plays of Shakespeare than anyone else.
How does that happen?
Because they've been written in the forest in the meantime.
I think why I've never gravitated towards it is because it's so big, and I feel like, am I going to get into this? But then I've got dozens, there's a lot of books there. And I think that turns a lot of people off. And I guess nobody's really explained that bit that you just did, that it's about a civilization cut off, a little bit like Le Guin would write about, where humanity has kind of spread out and then little parts of it are chopped off. So we're aware of our origins, but so much time has passed that you really are like a separate species almost. And then you get to meet each other again. So it's kind of about humanity, but you've been separated for so long that it's like, oh, okay. Which I do love that part of science fiction as well, where when you bring in, you know, time dilation and the size of the universe, once you get past a certain point, you can't keep an empire together because you can't communicate quick enough. So you are, once again, you're kind of isolated islands of people that do a different thing. I didn't realize it kind of went down that road. So it has to go on the list. Is that the first two that you've read there, or did you jump in the middle?
I I think it's possible to jump in at the middle, but you can. They are a series, and in terms of the characters' lives and so on, you know, if you read a book in the middle of the series, it might be you might find out things that are sort of plot elements in previous books, but they're not a closely knit series in that sense.
Right.
You can follow different. You're following much the same characters, but through different parts of their lives.
Yeah.
And once Cordelia has a son, a son, Miles. Miles Vorkosigan's adventures are just enormous, absolutely enormous fun. I can't recommend them enough. Well, you mentioned Le Guin, and I can't really not mention this. I mean, it's one of these, it's almost a cliche to say everybody should read it and so on.
Yeah, but it's true.
It's a novel that annoyed me and moved me in more or less equal measure the first time I read it,
mm-hmm.
which was, I guess, in my 20s. And in a way, Le Guin kind of, in this novel, she kind of stacked the deck against herself because she did the opposite of what Ian Banks did. I mean, Ian Banks envisaged making a classless, moneyless, stateless, etc. society, a society of free cooperation possible by having, you know, essentially inexhaustible resources and godlike AIs making sure everything worked. And Le Guin sets her communism, anarchism on a desert planet, a very harsh environment, and has people living lives that, unless you read it very, very carefully, you get the impression that their lives are pretty, pretty harsh too.
Yeah.
And she presents the planet that has remained under capitalism on one side and state capitalism on the other, to use the terms that they have in the novel, something analogous to the West and the old Eastern Bloc. She makes that planet look in many ways more attractive and lush, which it obviously is because it's a habitable Earth-like planet and a much more comfortable environment. But at the same time, she does think through the problems of her quote-unquote utopian society. Does it have a subtitle of an ambiguous utopia? I don't know.
Mm. Well, she liked writing in shades of grey, didn't she? It's not as simple as this moon is the utopia and the planet is the dystopia. It's all to do with opinions. And if you're part of that system, can you necessarily see the truth? Can you see the wood for the trees? I, she likes talking about that as well, which is why she's a fascinating writer, right?
Absolutely. I don't know if she was religiously a Taoist, but the philosophy of Taoism, which is, you know, that the famous yin-yang symbol, there's a light in the dark, but the dark always has a bit of light in it, and the light has a bit of dark, and they're completely intertwined. And so she sees with binocular vision, as it were, sees things in the round, and that is very much worked through both, you know, in terms of the plot and structurally the way the book is, because it has this very nice binary twining structure where you're following Shevek, first of all, on Arras, and then you get the backstory of his life growing up on Anaris and how they're twined together beautifully. Mm. And at the end, you get this as you mentioned earlier, you know, this shocking revelation that Earth is part of this Earth, you know, the ambassador from Earth turns up. And Earth is a much, much harsher of communism than Anaris. They've just had to completely brutal utilitarian rationing and everything on Earth, thanks to the climate catastrophe. It really makes you think.
She covers a lot of ground, right? And somewhere, like you say, with the yin and the yang, there is the solution, but it's a little bit of both of those places. So it's not like, it's not for the reader to pick which one is the better. It's not just like a reversal, like, you think the dystopia is the bad place, but actually it's not. You know, it is like somewhere in the middle of the book, there is the solution, but she really made people think. You know, you can't just get to the end of the book and go, there you go, it was a plot. Next, it's got to hang on you, just like the Left Hand of Darkness as well. It's never that simple, right?
Oh, yeah. The Left Hand of Darkness, I believe, I probably read that in when I was still at secondary school. And it may have been the first, it very possibly was the first Le Guin book that I read. And it is literally true that you come out of it and you come out of reading it and you literally see people differently because you suddenly see the sex polarity and the gender polarity and so on in a completely different light, at least for a few hours after finishing the book.
Yeah.
Just like the narrator, after he's lived so long on Geten, and suddenly these the people from Earth that he's from arrive, and they look so bizarre because they come in two obviously different sexes, and it just seems strange. Obviously, if you're looking for classics, again, there's Stand on Zanzibar, a great book which I read in probably 1970, about a year after it came out for the first time, and I lived through the year in which it is set, 2010. And of course, it's a very different 2010 from what Brunner imagined.
Yeah.
And it was quite a salutary experience rereading it and seeing what he got right and what he got wrong and why he had got things wrong. Another one a book whose impact is on a certain community, namely the people who are extremely online before anybody knew what online was, is A Deepness in the Sky by Bernard Vinge.
Mm. Oh, one of my favourites. I love
it. Oh, you've read it. You like it, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I love Fire Upon the Deep as well. I love what Vinge does in those books.
It's A Fire Upon the Deep is the one I meant.
Okay. Well, the one, Deepness in the Sky is the prequel, but it's kind of the same.
Yeah. It's what he did with The Deepness in the Sky is so dangerous and clever. Just as a writer, it was just so dangerous and clever. Because he's writing a prequel where you know from the rest of the book, that from the previous book that you've read, that these people are all completely trapped in the slower than light universe.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Big scale, though, isn't it? He. What I love about his writing was you've got the tight personal stories, the on the ground stuff, and then he always talks about something, you know, the time zones and different laws of physics, galaxy wide kind of thing, that don't necessarily affect people in the real time, but it's there as well. And that's always fascinated me how a writer. I think Alistair Reynolds does a similar thing where he'll talk about, you know, you'll pick a character and there's a noir detective story for you to read here, but it's also spread across this vast landscape. That's the kind of thing I really like as well. But it creeps up on you as you're reading it. it's not always obvious that that's what you're reading. I guess Dune does the same thing. You know, you're talking about a family that has to go through what families do with power, but it does affect thousands of years of history and, I guess, planet systems and things like that. Yeah, it baffles me how people like you can fit all this thing together, you know, into a book.
Well, I don't think I've tried anything on quite that, on, you know, quite that kind of scale. But I have done, I think I'm in on my, is it my third trilogy that I'm on now? And every time I write a trilogy, I swear I'll never write another, because it's keeping it all together in your head.
Yeah.
Is a challenge.
But more rewarding when you get to the end. I mean, you've told a bigger story, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of my ambitions is to write a really big, a big novel, you know, a longer novel that's not a trilogy.
Right.
And I may yet do that if I can ever persuade my editor that it's a good idea. But for the moment, what I'm working on is the second one of these. Mm-hmm. This is a near. And that rather unusual thing, a near future space opera, in that it starts in 2070.
Okay.
Or I think the year is 2070. And
2070. So is it realistic? This is where you think technology will be in 50 years?
Some technology, not the fast and light drive is the crucial thing that happens. And in that.
So you do write faster than light. You do include it.
In these books, yes. Mm. Have I done other books? Yes, I have. I did that with a kind of almost comic effect in a novel called Newton's Wake, which is a standalone space opera, which involved in the story several actual operas. And resurrecting dead people from stored minds and fragments of genetic information and so on and so forth, and a gigantic technological singularity which had happened sometime in the 21st century. And, you know, it is, and, you know, the singularity results in what they call the skein, which is wormholes spread out right across the galaxy.
Right.
All of that. So there's FTL in it, and FTL, and other kinds of FTL as well in it. And it, in that book, they have a word which, unfortunately, nobody else has managed to pick up on, which is fiddled.
Fiddle?
Fiddle, yes. We fiddled over.
Oh.
Meaning FTL traveled.
So you coined that as that's the way to describe when you make the jump, when you make the jump
to
light.
Yes, but it's never been taken up, so it doesn't appear in Brave New Words, which is a dictionary of science fiction terminology.
Yeah, I don't think there is like an agreed upon. I mean, there are the odds. I guess Bester would talk about jaunting, but that's kind of a teleportation, popping from one place to another, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. People just make the jump to light speed, don't they? They just kind of describe it more. Yeah. I guess when you're writing space opera, it's really important to decide before you start building that universe if you're going to have faster than light travel, because you're right, it makes a huge difference on what you can do. Because if you have to wait 3 years to go and talk to these people, it's like I was saying earlier, your civilization, you can't order people to do something because they're too far away. It's got to be local. So do you include wormholes? And I guess the singularity comes into that as well, because if you are talking about, you know, future humans, you have to decide whether this technological entity is going to emerge and kind of supersede everything. And I guess banks talk about banks a lot. But I guess he decided in his future, yes, it will come along and it will nurture us. It's okay to have it there. So before you write anything, do you kind of have to put those pieces on the board and say, well, we've got to get these in the ducks in a row before we get going?
Absolutely, yes. And, the Beyond the Hallowed Sky and its two sequels, which are, well, the one that's coming out next year is called Beyond the Reach of Earth. I definitely, my starting point for it was that it was about faster than light travel being discovered in the near future. And this is kind of a, a homage to my own youthful expectations, and that I thought when I was a kid, or when I was a teenager, that we would get FTL around about 2018, 2020 or so. It was bound to come.
Yeah.
We'd spread out there. Now, obviously that hasn't happened and probably won't, but you know, it can't stop me from saying, well, what if it did? And we can have fun speculating on that. And also, you know, what you were saying at the beginning about whether the view at the window is inspiring, the thing about the nuclear submarines is that we have in these novels, we have nuclear submarines being used as starships. Because they're ideally if you have your FTL drive, submarine is quite a good starship.
So the technology comes along and we're basically using old technology. So why use the submarine? Just because we already had them, and what do they shoot them off into space or?
There's a reason for that. But you'll have to read the book to find out.
Gotcha. Well, I guess they are, you know, rockets of the sea, whatever that means, right? It's a pressurized thing. I'm getting down into the nitty gritty of it. I'm trying to figure out why you would use submarines now.
To begin with, it's because the FTL drive is secret.
We
already have it, or some people already have it, like as in right now.
So from governments or from the public?
That's all in the book.
Well, that's interesting because there is the idea of emerging technology. A lot of science fiction writers assume that this is available for all mankind, right? For everybody. And not necessarily the case. Would governments, you know, these UFOs that we're seeing off the coast of California now, there's speculation of, it's stuff that we've already got, but it's a secret division of the US government and they're just not going to share it with anyone because it would change the world and stuff like that. And then us idiots get to guess what it actually is. Do you have an opinion on that? The UAPs and the Pentagon releasing videos of miraculously moving craft?
I'm deeply skeptical of the whole thing. I think that all these mysteriously moving objects sure don't look like objects to me. They're too much like... They're too much like, you know, reflections in a window, to put it crudely.
I think, what's the saying with the burden of proof, right? We're claiming something so spectacular.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yes.
And even, you know, press releases from the Pentagon, and then 2 years later, you don't get anything. I'm a bit, you know, it was quite exciting for a while. Wow, the government, the American government is getting involved and releasing stuff. And you look at it and think, man, we should have better images than that, or there should be so much. And I know people say, well, there is more. It'd be interesting if other governments join in and start doing the same thing. But I can't allow my brain to go that far because it's so spectacular. You know, just because I think it would be really cool if it was real doesn't make it more real, you know.
Good point. Yes, yes. I wrote a whole novel, Descent, which is based around the idea that, or ambiguously around the idea that an awful lot of UFO sightings and reports are disinformation. In fact, that the very idea of a government UFO cover-up is itself government disinformation to make not just the population, but more importantly, other governments think that just maybe we have this advanced alien technology.
Gotcha.
There's a terrific book and a quite entertaining documentary called, they're both the same title, Mirage Men.
Right.
By a guy who was started out, you know, as a UFO believer and an investigator and all of that. And he came to some interesting conclusions, but there is always that little hint of ambiguity, even in his book, that there could be something more going on behind it. And he leaves that, perhaps for literary reasons, he leaves that tantalizingly open. And, you know, I kind of do the same in Descent. But Descent is about a lad who encounters a light from the sky that knocks him down. And that night he has an alien abduction experience. And he knows he's going into an alien abduction experience because he's read about them. And then it gets takes a surprising turn, or I hope a surprising turn. And so, yeah, when I was a young science, well, I suppose in my teens, like just as I was interested in science fiction, I was kind of credulous about flying saucers, UFOs and all that.
Yeah.
And I eventually, you know, I did come to a more skeptical position. There is one science fiction novel about the UFO phenomenon, which I think captures it very, very well, and that is Miracle Visitors by Ian Watson.
And I don't know that one.
Oh, right. Well, it's...
I've got a couple of Ian Watson books, but I didn't know about that one.
That is well worth a read because it takes it in a very metaphysical direction eventually.
Okay.
But one that you might not, well, I certainly didn't expect when I started reading it. And that feeling of the, well, if you start, I think lots of people will say this, if you start taking the phenomenon seriously, you soon find out that there is simply no way to make sense of it all. That you have equally credible, quote-unquote, reports of things that, you know, unidentified aerial phenomena, fine. And then you get reports of completely bizarre, what they call high weirdness incidents.
Yeah.
Which are, you know, make you think, what the hell is that supposed to be about? And many of these, of course, are simply hoaxes or misidentifications. But that feeling that there's something slipping away from your grasp as you try to grasp it, is in Watson's book becomes the essence of the phenomenon.
What do you think the actual not Fermi paradox or what's really out there, but do you think it's just more likely that something like James Webb will detect organic life 50 light years away? That would be good enough for me. You know, proof that life didn't start one time in one place, which is all we have at the moment, which is a bit disappointing. You think something like that can happen in the next, I don't know, 20 years or so?
Well, sure. I mean, this week's Today's New Scientist has a cover piece about the James Webb Telescope and the search for alien life. And I think, you know, if there is life on some exoplanet, then we're probably we are close enough to detecting it.
Wow.
I've always, well, once I started thinking things through, you know, the Fermi paradox does strongly suggest that the kind of universe that we imagined in Golden Age science fiction, or that is imagined in, say, Star Trek, where there are lots of alien species at roughly the same level of technology as us, or a bit more advanced, and that we're all going to meet out there somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that they all follow the prime directive, so that's why we don't know about them. It's deeply implausible. There are abstract arguments in favor of the idea that, you know, life and even intelligent life is more common than we think. There are arguments that the discovery of life elsewhere, particularly if you have multicellular life, would be very bad news indeed. Because of, oh, yes, it would be very bad news indeed. This is Nick Bostrom's great filter argument.
Mm-hmm.
The argument about the great filter is that something is, the reason we don't see any alien civilizations is there aren't any. And if there aren't any, something is stopping them. And if what is stopping the emergence of alien civilizations out there is something far in our past, like that it's wildly improbable that life should emerge, or it's wildly improbable that multicellular life should emerge, or it's wildly improbable that intelligent life should emerge, then we can be fairly confident that there's no big doom up ahead.
Right.
If, on the other hand, if technological civilizations turned out to be 10 a penny, but there weren't any currently existing, it would mean that there was some unknown great destroyer, great filter up ahead of us, and that we might destroy ourselves. Whatever.
Is that Nick Bostrom? I mean, he has a way with words, that guy. I mean, he also proposes that we are living in a simulation, which if you put those two ideas together, then the great filter isn't a real thing. It's it's fabricated into this reality. I mean, that's stepping a little bit too far ahead there, but...
I find Nick Bostrom's entire mode of thinking quite, and that whole, you know, so-called rationalist current, you know, long-termist and rationalist type thinking, which leads to these things like worries about unfriendly AI, or worries about the great filter being waiting for us to scythe us down at any moment. And a lot of arguments like that start off from some apparently incontestable first principle and build up an elaborate structure of inference from it without ever checking it against the real world. I think that whole mentality is not doing us any good whatsoever. Take, for example, another Bostrom, I think it was Bostrom who wrote, I think he had wrote a paper called something like Astronomical Waste or Cosmic Waste, which is that all these stars that are shining that don't have any intelligent life around them mm-hmm. are like lights left on in empty rooms, that this colossal unspeakable waste is happening all the time, and we have this moral duty to somehow capture this energy for intelligent and hopefully happy life, even if that intelligent and hopefully happy life is people living in simulated paradises.
Yeah.
Around in Dyson spheres or whatever, around other stars. This strikes me as something that is entertaining as science fiction, but should get nowhere near any serious discussions of policy.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he writes that kind of thing and believes every word of it. It does seem logical when you spell things out like that. He's very good at that. If it's all Bostrom, I'm not sure if it's all Bostrom, but those kind of writers, okay?
Yeah.
And they hit you with logic. And it seems as though there aren't jumps in some of the factoring early on in that equation. But so I'm not sure they're trying to trick people into thinking that simplistically, or whether there is a lot of truth in it that we don't want to know. But we still have to we have to make these great leaps to take that in. And I'm not sure we can do much with it. Like the simulation theory, it's interesting. I love thinking about it, and I think it's got there's a lot of things that are undeniable in my brain about it, but it doesn't mean you're going to change the way you live, right? The same with the lights left on around the universe. It's not just free energy that we just can't be bothered to go and get. If we could, I'm sure we would, right? It's, you know, doesn't help much about the real world in real time, does it?
No. No, there's a very good short story by, now unfortunately I've forgotten the author, but the author, it's a very famous short story called Divided by Infinity,
mm-hmm.
Which I'll leave you to find for yourself. But
I'll look for it, yeah.
Yeah, but one of the characters in that says that her way of judging sort of philosophical speculation like that, or like the ones in that story, is, does it make you a better person? Do you get any good out of it? Can you make good on it, literally? And if you can't, then it's just a bubble floating over the landscape. You don't need to bother about it. There is actually a lot that is challengeable in utilitarianism, for instance, the greatest happiness of the greatest number, etc. And a lot that is challengeable in the idea of that, even at a simulation, that people living in a simulation is even possible, that an emulation of the human brain can be created in any kind of near future, and so on, or indeed any future that we can reach. So it's, yeah, I think we have more, really more serious things to worry about right now. So
yeah. Well, those conversations are complete rabbit holes, aren't they? Because if you start accepting the fact that the simulation is real, who's to say that this simulated version of us could be 1% of what we actually are, you know? So it's not, or you know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't have to be a complete representation of this real entity outside. But then if you are accepting that simulation, it starts to get a little bit religious, because the controllers of this simulation will never know for sure if they're not in a similar thing, and it goes all the way up to God, doesn't it? I'm not a religious person, but it just keeps going and going. You're like, well, then what is the point in it, whether we are or not? It's an interesting, you know, I enjoy reading about it, but you're right. Does it make us better people? Absolutely not. it's a cool thing to talk about around a campfire, you know, or on a video like this. You before you go, you wanted to talk about like the future of science fiction or the current state of I guess literature, where we are.
Oh, I only meant that it was a bigger topic than I really could deal with, because you asked what the cutting edge is now to replace, you know, if cyberpunk isn't, and we know it isn't. I think climate fiction is a serious look at what is happening, given that we are busy terraforming Earth into something suitable for a very different species. So that's an important thing. I'm halfway through Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future.
I'm just looking at it. I finished it a few days ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I thought it was terrifying, because if he's if Kim is 10% on the money, I wouldn't say we're doomed, but, and I won't spoil the book, but there are just massive hurdles that I think we need to get over before we even start to put things back together. It's quite a scary book, and I think he done the research, so maybe a lot of it is accurate. Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, in a grim sort of way. Yes, I am. And the other thing that is going on, obviously, in science fiction at the moment is new voices from newly industrializing countries, from black people, from women, from outside of Europe and North America. And I know that I haven't sufficiently explored that. I read The Three-Body Problem, and I think I'm yet to read the third of that trilogy. That's a novel from China, and it was a big international success.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I've read the first one, and I'm constantly told you've got to finish the trilogy, because I found it quite cold. I love the idea. I love what happens in the book. I didn't really like the writing too much. I don't know whether that's a translation thing, but I'm told that it's better. Have you gone further? You've read the second one as well, right?
I believe I have read the second one. I'll have to look back on my Kindle to check that. But anyway, yes, the thing is that it gives you a very different taste of, that you're tasting something new and different. And it is, as you said, perhaps cold, yes, but it's very much, I think, a thing that was in Golden Age SF that we have lost, which is this engineering mentality being applied to everything, because the author is an engineer, or was, and that every problem can in principle be solved if you put enough, if you think hard enough and put enough resources into solving it.
Yeah.
And the way it escalates into situations where, there are space battles in these books that like you have never seen. And destruction on a scale you've never seen. And but there is a kind of, there's a really strong humanist perspective in it. And I think it is the idea that we can overcome difficulties if we try hard enough. And this is a spirit that we don't see so much of here.
Eurocentric.
I
guess we've had the floor for so long, right? Yeah. You know, the vast majority of this library is written by white middle-aged men, right? Mostly British and American. That's not because I handpicked them. That's just the history of science fiction. So Yeah, I think you're right. From now on, we get these other perspectives. All right, there's a bit of Polish and Russian, the obvious places where it comes from, and it does feel it does feel different. Again, I'm not sure if it's always because of translation, or I guess the author's growing up in a completely different system, because most of this is, you know, the Western world has produced this science fiction, and things are changing. So interesting times ahead, but I wonder how long this climate bubble will last, because, you know, Kim Stanley Robinson's one thing, but I don't see a big rush of it that people are talking about. I think just from the community, you can see people talking more about people. Science fiction in general is more talking about civilization and us a lot more. And there don't seem to be as much of the techno spacefaring stuff. Or if it is, it is about family units and people. So maybe science fiction has got a bit softer over the last couple of decades.
I think there is something in that. And I have a feeling that there are new types of science fiction to be developed. There was a movement, or there was a manifesto and a bubble of excitement about 10, 15 years ago, what was called mundane SF, where the idea was that you should try writing SF that is actually within the constraints of what we scientifically know, which is that there is no FTL, there is no godlike AI. We're stuck on this planet. We're not changing it at the moment very much for the better, and so on. And write science fiction stories set in universes where all of these are true. And it isn't quite as much of a constraint. You can do a lot within the constraints. Like, you can have complete space operas that are set within the solar system. But the idea was that science fiction is giving us too many easy options, for too many get out of jail free cards, as it were, and we should concentrate on the actual jail. Now, Ian Watson, I remember him being very scornful of the whole idea. He just dismissed it with fury. He said, this is an attempt to limit our imaginations. I'm having none of it. I will write speculative fiction about whatever I like, or words
of
to
course.
That effect.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I agree in the spirit of that. But I do think that there are amazing stories to be told about what could be realistically possible in the not too, and then, you know, in the fairly near future in the solar system.
Yeah.
And that the, you know, you could have genuinely exciting adventures that, as you say, are very much about people and civilization, but have the spacefaring done as it most likely will be, which is largely by machines, by probes.
Yeah.
For example, I mean, it is one of these, it is actually technologically feasible to, not in the very near future, but, you know, in the next few decades, to, if you could send a swarm of small probes propelled by, you know, light sails and laser propelled light sails.
Yeah.
You could get them up to 10% of the speed of light and get a camera and a radio to Alpha Centauri over only 40 years, which seems...
And then send that signal back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would be... I think that would be an awesome achievement. Absolutely awesome.
You're talking about Van Neumann probes. So when they get there,
It's not even that. It's just
just a scout, something to go and look.
Yeah.
But this is part of the, not necessarily the Fermi paradox. Well, maybe it is. When you think about the scale of things, just getting something up to that speed and getting it there, and as soon as it gets there, it sends the images back. It's 80-year round trip, right? Because it's got to come back. Well, the signal's got to come back.
The signal comes back in 4 years.
Ah, all right, 44 years. It's still... Yeah. These are still like, you know, half a lifetime for people. And then when you, and that's the nearest star. This always blows my mind. That's just the next door neighbor. And then you look at the scale of one galaxy. And then you start to realize, okay, the size of the universe, even the observable universe, maybe too big for civilizations to communicate, because if they've been able to communicate for thousands of years, even at light speed, then we might just be too far apart. And then the finite part of that, which is the age of the universe, even though we're talking billions of years, there is still only a slither of time for things to have evolved and happen and be, you know, get to that point. So suddenly, these grand numbers are a lot smaller than you think. They are tangible. So the Fermi paradox may just be life is rare, the universe is really big, and it isn't an infinite amount of time. We have only got that Goldilocks part of time before we could have even started doing stuff. And I'm not sure if that's comforting or not. It may be a solution, but again, just because I want that to be true and that there are some rare aliens out there and we'll detect them one day doesn't make it real. We could be all alone. That's quite terrifying, isn't it? That life was a complete one-off fluke and this is it?
Well, I think it just tells us whether it's a one-off fluke or not. You know, it is evidently rare and worth preserving, and I think it gives us a feeling of huge amount of responsibility that we have, especially as we know that we're right at the beginning of things. If we're not at the end of things, then we're at the beginning of something huge. Even if we never get off this planet, there are still, you know, millions, tens of millions, trillions of human lives ahead of us, you know, and we have to, well, I don't say we have to, but we should be aware that... They are in the balance, you know.
It's quite fitting that you're reading the Ministry for the Future, because, yeah, that's what was terrifying about it. That the people that have that power and control seem to be the ones that want to hold on to money and power and control, and not really care too much about tomorrow or these bigger ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really hard to shift that. You know, that level of thinking out of the way without disaster happening first. So that's kind of what Kim's writing about there, and it feels very realistic. If we're gonna turn the ship around, yeah, we may have to cut the head off and kind of, you know, rebuild what we do before we start getting better. But there you go. Well, I hope you enjoy that book. I haven't stopped thinking about it. It's my first Kim Stanley Robinson as well, believe it or not. So,
yeah, he was at COP26 in Glasgow. He stayed with us a couple of nights. I've known him for
quite
a long time. He knew Ian and me. He's visited Scotland a few times. Really likes it. Wow. He's amazing. He's just fascinated living in being in a country where water falls out of the sky and pours off the hills.
Yeah.
He lives in California.
Yeah, they would love a bit of that at the moment, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but he likes hiking in the High Sierra. So it's, you know, the High Sierra, he said it's just like the Highlands, except it's 10,000 feet higher to start with.
Oh, I didn't realize it. Oh, yeah, of course. He writes books about that kind of thing, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
I used to live up in that part of the world. I lived about 20 miles outside of Yosemite Park.
Wow.
In the Gold Rush district. And for a couple of summers, I lived in the park. I was a rock climber's buddy. I was a mule. I carried packs to the top of El Cap for mm-hmm. rock climbers for when they climbed up the actual rock face.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress, but good times. Well, hopefully I'll get to talk to Kim about that kind of thing.
Yeah, he calls himself Stan, by the way.
That's, Stan. Oh, yeah, sorry.
No, I didn't know that until somebody told me, so there you go. Yeah, and you actually should get in touch with him. I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you.
We're emailing people in the background and you know, we drop hints of who we are, who we've interviewed. So my next email to Stan will be, well, look, Ken has spoken to me, so he told me that you have to come on the show and have a chat about rock climbing and climate change. I'm sure he'll love that. So
yeah.
Well, it sounds like a good place to wrap up. Do you want to plug any book in particular? Your current series? Shall I leave links in the description, or do you want to point people in any direction?
Oh, please do. I mean, there is this book, and the next volume is available for pre-order.
Okay.
You can get this in paperback or on ebook or Kindle, mm-hmm. Audible as well. So the next one is coming out next year, and the final volume of that trilogy is the one I'm working on at the moment. as with my previous 18 novels, let me tell you, writing novels doesn't get any easier with practice. It just doesn't.
I go through the effort, though, I hope.
Head clutching every single time.
maybe next year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Going for next year.
Yeah. This novel is due. I'll be delivering it at the beginning of June 23, and be coming out in 2024, all being well.
Okay. Yeah. I'll leave the links down below and your greatest hits as well, so people will be able to find your stuff.
Great.
Ken McLeod, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Mike.